Okay, so, yeah. Well, not exactly this. No, nothing to do with mice. So, first of all, the copier didn't get my photocopy order, so that's why you had to use your own paper. Then, when I came in, I realized that the people who set up weren't entirely clear on what we were supposed to be doing. So, we're not really prepared for today, lab-wise. Which means I'm going to give you two lectures today, and we're going to do two lab exercises tomorrow. I mean, not tomorrow. Wednesday. Okay? So we're going to do the plasmids one, which we were going to do to begin with. But instead of doing the lab exercise, which was the transformation with PGLO, we'll do the other Wednesday's lecture.
So is it going to be like two separate recordings or just one long one?
No, it'll be two separate, as always. Now, once we do the plasmids exercise, which will be Wednesday, it won't really make any sense without knowing about what plasmids are. And so that's what this lecture is about. This first slide doesn't really show you plasmids, but it shows you the results of an important historical experiment. Yeah. It won't affect the test. The test isn't Wednesday.
The quiz.
Oh, the quiz. The quiz will be over both, right? The quiz, as usual, will be about whatever I talk about today. You're going to have to do both activities. Okay, now, in this experiment, which is called the Griffith experiment, this was done before we knew anything about plasmids, but it's important in the history because this was an experiment that gave evidence, first experimental evidence, that DNA is the molecule of inheritance. So we knew heredity worked. We knew that for millennia, right? We've recognized since before the days of science that parents pass offspring, pass traits on to their offspring. So we knew that things did inherit characteristics, but we did not know how that worked. And so back in the days when we were guessing, there must be some molecular basis. There must be, in other words, a particle of inheritance, which we all know nowadays is DNA, that hadn't yet been experimentally shown. So this was an important experiment in the history of figuring out inheritance, and specifically in figuring out that DNA is that genetic material. In this experiment, they used mice, non-volunteer mice, that were injected with bacteria that are able to cause pneumonia and other problems. But this bacterium comes in two different strains, two different varieties. It's the same species, but two different varieties, which are the S variety and the R variety, or S strain and R strain. And the S strain is the nasty stuff. It's virulent, which means it causes the problems. Whereas the R strain does not. All right? So in these first two sets of results, there's no surprise here. The first group of mice was injected with the nasty stuff, the S strain. And not surprisingly, they died. It's the nasty bacterium. Also not surprisingly, a different group of mice who were injected with the harmless kind, the R strain, survived. It didn't do anything wrong to them because it's the harmless stuff. In the third one, this really isn't a surprise either. The third batch of mice, they first heat killed the bacteria, the nasty stuff, But it was dead before they injected it into them. So yeah, it was the nasty strain, but it was dead before they injected it into the mouse, and therefore, not surprisingly, the mice didn't die. Because dead things don't cause disease, right? Living things do. In the fourth one, though, that's the important result. In this fourth batch of mice, they heat killed some nasty bacteria, just like in the third one. But then they mixed those already dead nasty bacteria with living harmless ones, the R strain. And then that mixture was injected into these new mice. And even though there were no living nasty cells that were injected, the mice died. Not only did the mice die, but when they drew blood from the dead mice, they found living S strain bacteria, the nasty ones. So in other words, they demonstrated that there must be something about the ones that were nasty but were killed that was transferred to the living ones, some particle that caused the harmless ones to change their characteristic, change their trait, made them become S variety, the nasty ones. And therefore, they showed, basically, that there is actually a molecule of inheritance. There's a molecule that determines what your traits are. And if that molecule gets transferred to another organism, that organism that receives that particle will have different traits. So we now know that what happened here was called bacterial transformation. Transformation is the process by which bacteria, under certain circumstances, are able to take up DNA from the environment. In this case, it was DNA that was just spilled out of these dead bacteria, the nasty dead ones, that was taken in by these non-nasty living ones, and now all of a sudden they have new DNA and therefore new characteristics. Now, this second slide shows you how plasmids are involved. Before we get to a plasmid, though, who can tell me what a chromosome is?
A single piece of DNA that's been wrapped around histones and the form structure.
That's right. That's right for a eukaryotic organism. Actually, in bacteria, you don't have the histones. But the important point that I wanted, and you're right about, is that a single chromosome consists of one giant DNA molecule. In the case of eukaryotic cells, depending on the species, each cell will contain some number of different chromosomes. And they are linear, right? We talked about that. Whereas in a prokaryotic cell, there's just one chromosome, and it's circular. So it doesn't really have a beginning or an end. It's just it's a circular ribbon-like structure, which is what's depicted in red here. So it's still two strands that are held together by hydrogen bonds, but it's one long chromosome. There aren't multiple chromosomes. And what do chromosomes contain? What are the pieces of chromosomes that actually operate for transcription? What are those things called? Genes. A gene is just a segment of the overall length of a chromosome, but it's enough nucleotides in that segment to code for a complete protein. Right? So that's true for both kinds of cells as well. So on this single chromosome that this bacterium has are some number of genes. That number of genes determines what kinds of proteins that bacterium is able to make, and therefore it determines indirectly the traits that this bacterium has, because its proteins directly give it its traits. All right? Now, the genes on a chromosome are essential genes. So the bacterial chromosome contains all the genes that are necessary for that gene, for that bacterium to survive under normal conditions. But I just told you a little bit ago that a bacterium can undergo transformation. So it can start out with its one chromosome, that's all of its necessary genes, but it can take in DNA from some other organism. It doesn't even have to be another bacterium. If there's DNA out in the environment, its immediate surroundings, and if the conditions are correct, the bacterium can take up that DNA, which is just a little snippet of DNA, into itself, in which case whatever genes that new DNA that it takes in is carrying are now going to be able to give that bacterium the ability to make new proteins, because it's like a library taking extra books in. Now you have extra manuals, so you can make more proteins, and these proteins are going to give the bacterium additional abilities that it didn't have when it had just its own chromosome. All right? Well, these little snippets of DNA that get taken up by bacterium during transformation are called plasmids. And so a plasmid is a little bit like the bacterial chromosome, just not as big. Plasmids are little circular pieces of DNA. They contain a fewer number of genes than the chromosome does, because they're smaller. And those genes aren't genes that are absolutely necessary for that bacterium to survive. Those genes allow the bacterium to have extra properties. If a bacterium successfully does take up DNA by transformation, that DNA is the same stuff that the chromosome is made out of. So just like a chromosome gets replicated right before a bacterium splits into two, which we've talked about, right? The other main job of DNA, besides transcription, is self-replication. And that's in preparation for cell division. So a bacterium that's about to divide copies its chromosome, so it has two whole chromosomes, but then it becomes two cells, each with one chromosome. Well, the plasmid DNA gets replicated just like the chromosomal DNA does. And so you see that right here. These plasmids happen to be in this bacterium. If it divides into two new bacteria, everything will be copied. The chromosome itself and the plasmid DNA. Okay, now the bottom of this figure shows you that plasmids don't always stay separate from the chromosome. In the top, they stayed separate. But in the bottom, this one plasmid, which has previously been taken up by this cell, is now going to be integrated into the chromosome. And now it's really just part of the chromosome, although it's not necessarily a permanent part. Integration of a plasmid into the chromosome can actually be reversed. So, in a sense, the bacterium knows what the red material is. That's its own chromosome, and it doesn't mess with that. But this blue snippet that's part of the chromosome after it's been integrated could be snipped back out. So you could return to this position, basically. And it actually doesn't really matter whether it's integrated or not as far as making the proteins is concerned. And that's because as long as those genes are present, it doesn't matter whether they're present on a plasmid by itself or as part of the chromosome, they can still be transcribed, can still make messenger RNA out of them, out of their codes, and then those can go on to ribosomes to be translated into proteins. Okay? But whether it's integrated or not, plasmids, the DNA of plasmids is replicated. So it gets passed on to the next generation of cells. All right, well, that's a natural process. Bacteria do this just in the normal course of living. But as far as biotechnology is concerned, we exploit their ability to do this for our own purposes. In other words, we use plasmids and bacteria to move genes around. All right? Now, if we have a gene that we're interested in, and we would like to get that into a bacterium, first of all, it doesn't matter where that gene came from. And why doesn't it matter?
Because DNA is shared by all things.
Not only DNA, but the genetic code is the same. The genetic code is universal, so every organism is going to read that code the same way and therefore make the same protein. So maybe this gene that we're interested in is from one kind of bacterium, maybe not. It could be from a dog, whatever. The point is, we would like to have this bacterium make the protein for us. So all we need to do is have this gene be part of a plasmid that bacteria can actually take up like they would naturally through transformation. All right, that's where we are performing the biotechnology. We're interfering with their what they do normally. Well, it's useful to be able to tell whether the bacteria that you're trying to get transformed with the plasmid you're working on, whether that actually went correctly or not. And really, there's millions of bacteria in a small space. But transformation is not automatic. It's difficult. The conditions have to be just right. And even when the conditions are just right, most of the bacteria do not successfully transform. They don't take up the plasmid even if it's there. So if you're working with bacteria and you're trying to get some of them to transform by taking up the plasmid that you design that's carrying your gene, the gene you're interested in studying, you really would like to work with only bacteria that have successfully taken up the plasmid. You don't want to include the bacteria that did not, right? So it's useful to include in your plasmid, which you're designing as a scientist, include in that plasmid a different gene, not the gene you're working on, but alongside that one you're interested in, include a different gene that can act as a marker that will allow you to separate bacteria that didn't take it up from bacteria that did. All right? That's what we're seeing here. This plasmid that's shown in blue and yellow, the yellow part of that is a gene for antibiotic resistance. Now, antibiotics, remember, are substances that kill bacteria. But if a bacterium has the correct kind of gene, then it will not be killed by that specific kind of antibiotic, whichever kind it is. Depends on the gene. Okay? Well, this is useful to us because if we're working with bacteria that normally are not resistant, that means bacteria will be killed unless they do take up the plasmid we're working on. Right? Because if they successfully transform by taking up this plasmid, They'll now have this new gene they didn't have before that'll allow them to survive the antibiotic. Well, what we do is use this kind of off-the-shelf plasmid that already has that antibiotic resistance gene in it, and we insert a new gene, the one that we're actually interested in studying, into this plasmid, so that both the antibiotic resistance gene and the gene of interest is given to the bacteria that successfully transform. And we do that by cutting our gene, the gene of interest, from a bigger piece of DNA with a special kind of enzyme called a restriction endonuclease. All right, the word endonuclease tells you that it's an enzyme. Specifically, it's a kind of nuclease. Nuclease is just a word that means an enzyme that's able to cut a nucleic acid. DNA is a nucleic acid. So what nucleases do actually is snip the phosphodiester bonds that hold the sugar phosphate backbone together. In other words, they do the opposite of what's done when DNA is built one nucleotide at a time. They break those bonds, so instead of having a long strand, you have shorter strands. That's what nuclease means. Endo just means within. So an endonuclease is an enzyme that makes a cut somewhere in the interior of the length rather than cutting one nucleotide off of the end. Cuts it somewhere in the middle. All right. Now these restriction endonucleases, which I'm going to talk more about in a little bit, they leave what are called sticky ends. You know, a DNA is double-stranded. But if the strands are not the same length, if they don't match up entirely, they have ends sticking out of them. Ends that don't have any complementary nucleotide on the other strand. But whatever that sequence is, that corresponds to a complementary sequence that it would stick to naturally if it existed. Well, if they cut this plasmid with the same kind of enzyme that they cut the red DNA with, then the sticky ends are going to be complementary to each other. And therefore, if they just mix these cut plasmids with these cut out genes, they'll naturally go right into that loop. Okay? So now you've made a plasmid that has your gene of interest, which is this purple piece within the red, and you also have a marker gene, the yellow one, which is going to confer antibiotic resistance, which is going to allow you to tell apart bacteria that have taken this plasmid up from bacteria that have not. All right, this is your normal bacterium that you're starting with. All it has is its own chromosome. This is the engineered plasmid with the two genes. If it takes it up, then whether it takes it up or not, you have a whole population of bacteria, some of which took it up, some of which didn't. If you then plate those bacteria onto an agar plate that has that antibiotic in it, the only ones that are going to be able to survive that are the ones you care about, the ones that took up the plasmid. So after that antibiotic treatment, 100% of the bacteria that are remaining will be just the ones you're interested in, the ones that have successfully taken up the plasmid. That's how the gene acts as a marker gene. It allows you to separate the two kinds. These will die. All right, well, that's just exactly what's shown in slide 4, and this is what we'll be doing. All right, we have source DNA, that is what the gene of interest is that I keep talking about. So whatever that is. In our case, the gene of interest is going to be a gene called P-GLO, which codes for a protein called GFP, sorry. GFP stands for green fluorescence protein. So this green fluorescence protein will glow if you shine ultraviolet light onto it. This came from a jellyfish. So the jellyfish naturally has this gene and therefore naturally makes this protein and naturally glows if you shine it with ultraviolet light. But we're going to put this gene into bacteria that normally don't have it, of course. Okay, so that's the source DNA, the P-GLO gene. But we're also going to have along with it an antibiotic resistance gene. Specifically, a gene that allows resistance to ampicillin. There's different kinds of antibiotics. The antibiotic we'll be using is ampicillin. So ampicillin will kill bacteria that do not have this gene. All right, so we're going to have just a tiny little vial of plasmids. It looks like there's almost no fluid there, but there's millions of plasmids in there. And that's why you're using a micropipetter to move these things. You introduce the plasmids into the solution that contains the living but normal, non-transformed bacteria, and we're going to be using E. coli as our bacteria. All right. Then we do some stuff to it that make it more likely that transformation will occur. Remember I said the conditions have to be just right? So we make the conditions as perfect as possible for transformation to occur, but still, it's only going to occur in a minority of these bacteria. And then we plate them out. If we plate them out onto a plate that does not have antibiotics on it, then both kinds of bacteria will grow, the ones that didn't take it up and the ones that did take it up. Neither one of them will be killed. And that's exactly why you need a marker gene, because you won't be able to tell which of these colonies came from bacteria that did take up the P-GLO gene and ones that didn't. So instead, you plate them out onto one that has ampicillin in the gel. And the ones that did not take it up will not grow. These ones, you must have successfully taken up the plasmid. Therefore, you can just keep reproducing them to make as many as you want. Slide 5 just gives you a little bit more information about what is done in this process. What is CaCl2? Right, it's calcium chloride, which is a kind of salt. And calcium chloride, at the presence of calcium chloride in the environment, in the solution that you're growing these bacteria in, that increases what we call the competence. Competency refers to the likelihood that a bacterium will successfully transform. Calcium chloride increases that likelihood, so we say that it makes these bacteria more competent. But also so does the correct temperature, which is why we saw in last time a specific temperature. All right. So as long as you have the conditions right and you actually have the plasmid present, because you're pipetting it into the colony of bacteria, into the tube of bacteria, then some small fraction of the bacteria will actually take the plasmid up. But we don't care that it's only a small fraction, because we're going to kill the rest of them by exposing all of them to ampicillin. Any questions on that? All right, well, this last slide, 6, just shows you a similar process. Now, a vector refers to some way of transferring DNA from one organism to another. And a plasmid, for instance, is a vector. But you could also use a virus. Now, bacteria do transform naturally. They undergo transformation naturally. Animal cells don't. So we are stuck with whatever DNA we get at birth. We can be exposed to DNA in our environment, and we don't take it up like bacteria do and start expressing new traits. We're stuck with whatever DNA we got or the mistakes that can make during our lifetime, which are mutations, which is basically what causes cancer. But it's possible to do a very similar thing to transformation in animal cells. You just use a virus to do the job. So you design a virus that actually has DNA in it, like all viruses do, well, almost all of them. You insert the gene that you really care about transferring to the animal cell into that viral DNA. So the virus now is carrying the gene of interest. And you let the virus do what it naturally does, which is infect the animal cell. But when it infects its animal cell, remember what we said viruses do. They inject their DNA into the cell, and that cell then is fooled into thinking that DNA is its own DNA. Well, if you design the DNA that the virus has, then you are controlling what kind of DNA gets delivered into that cell. And so this has the same effect as transformation, but it's not true transformation because animal cells don't normally undergo transformation. It's just using a vector, a different kind of vector, a viral vector. Okay, that's one slideshow. Let's take a little break, and I'll talk more about restriction endonucleases.